From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll hear from a couple of women today on today's show who don't like things as they are. First, a food writer who says men have started to take over the industry in the South, and that leaves us hungry for some honest commentary on what we all eat and why.
Chocolate lava cake is not just undercooked chocolate cake. That's not what makes the center molten. You take a frozen cylinder of ganache and you set it in the ramekin so that as the outside cooks fully, the inside becomes molten.
Then we'll hear from a recent college grad who spent her senior year in silence but still managed to find her voice. First, though, we talked tips on yesterday's show. Researcher Zach Brewster of Wayne State University joined us to share about what race has to do with gratuities.
African Americans, compared to white, are on average less familiar with this 15 to 20% tipping norm. They tend to tip, on average, less than whites. But also it's the case that service makes a difference. So even if customers' perceptions of service quality are not sensitive to service discrimination, there are obviously going to be times where African Americans are not given as good a service, and their tips are going to reflect that.
So what do you think of the income versus gratuity model? Here are your first thoughts. Catherine Napkina reached out to us on Facebook. She says, like many young actors, my daughter did stints as wait staff in restaurants and as cast slash waiter slash bartender in dinner theater. I think few people understand that waiters are not really paid and tips are their income. I've never forgotten shock on my husband's face when our daughter loaned him a book with a check stub for $0 from her restaurant. So yes, a good waiter in a good restaurant can bring down great bucks, but for many, it's an edgy existence. We also, I asked, at least, if you had ever come across a tip jar that you felt was out of place, and we got an interesting answer to this one.
Hey, Celeste, this is Nick Baum, Savannah. The most egregious example I've seen of this is along the same lines. It was when I was riding a bus in Savannah. There was actually a box at the front of the bus asking people to donate school supplies. The most abject and forlorn in any society, our bus riders are now being asked to stock our public schools. It's incredible.
So, yeah, not exactly a tip jar, but I get the similarity, Nick. Thanks so much for your call. And we always love to get these stories from you. Nick reached us at 404-500-9457. Catherine posted at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. And we're also on Twitter at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The National Park Service turns 100 this year. Now, Georgia is not home to any national parks, but there are more than a dozen historic sites, trails, and heritage areas spread across the Peach State. One of those is Kennesaw Mountain. It's built on a Civil War battlefield. The Battle of Kennesaw Mountain in 1864 claimed more than 4,000 lives, both Union and Confederate lives. But hundreds of those casualties went undocumented until very recently. 238 United States colored troops remain unidentified in the Marietta Cemetery. But historian Brad Quinlan wants to uncover more information about those black soldiers. He served as lead researcher for the 2013 documentary Kennesaw, One Last Mountain. Welcome, Brad.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
How did they called them the colored regiments. How did they end up at Kennesaw?
Well, they had the, in March of 1862, they were allowed to have the USCT troops form. But it was handling at such a slow time frame that they passed another law in March of 1863 to allow for white regiments to enlist former slaves or slaves into their regiments as undercooks, not as privates, but as undercooks. They would take on and do these menial chores of cooking, shining boots for the officers, and different things like that.
They were not armed.
They were not armed. And on May 8, 1864, as General Sherman's beginning his Atlanta campaign, he gave an order, order number 62, and it would state that all musicians, cooks, undercooks, and noncombatants would wear a white armband on their left sleeve and become stretcher bearers, putting themselves now in harm's way. Just a few months before, they were slaves, and now they were going out across the battlefields of the Atlanta campaign, saving the lives of white soldiers.
Now, stretcher bearers didn't wait until a battle was over to go and provide medical care. These were people that were running out in the midst of a fight, right? To pull people out of the battle.
In the midst of the firing was still going on, they're running out with a stretcher and going up to wounded soldiers as the mini balls were flying around.
All right. So one of the people you track down, the story, is featured in that 2013 documentary, a freed slave named Austin Gilmore.
Unarmed, Austin Gilmore attempts to save a Union soldier wounded on Pigeon Hill. The former slave is struck in the hip by a mini ball. Yet Gilmore manages to drag the soldier to safety.
Did Austin Gilmore die at Kennesaw Mountain?
He was mortally wounded. He died in a hospital in Rome, Georgia on July 4th, 1864.
It couldn't have been easy to track down any information on freed slaves that were fighting. What was that? What has this research trip been like for you?
It's been a great journey, and a journey that I never thought would lead in this direction. I started to do research on the Marietta National Cemetery. And as a researcher and a novice in the Civil War, I'd always heard that General Sherman had no men of African descent with him in the Atlanta campaign. I walk up to Section F. Here's 258 of these men that are buried in that section. I had to know what their story was, and thanks to the National Archives in Washington, D.C., they allowed me to pull the rare records of muster rolls.
How did you know, when you go to the Marietta Cemetery, how do you know that those are African Americans buried there?
It says on some of the headstones, it says USCT soldier. Many of them, though, are just...
Which stands for United States Colored Troops.
And many of them are just a small block of marble with a number on top. Then I find, thanks to Dr. David Evans, Chaplain Thomas Van Horn's original burial records. In there, he documents the incredible story of these men.
All right, so let's play another clip from the documentary, Kennesaw, One Last Mountain. This is the narration of Asa Soper, who is actually describing the care that he was provided by a freed slave, a woman named Emma Stevenson.
The few nurses here work all day and night. We have a slave woman who cares for us on this floor. She has kindness and treats us with tender care. But my only hope is to come home to you, Asa.
How did African-American women feature in these battles like the one at Kennesaw?
And it's so very rare. When I walked up into Section F, here's a headstone.
Of the cemetery.
Of the National Cemetery in Marietta. Here's a headstone that says Emma Stevenson, nurse, July 16th, 1864. She's buried in the African-American section from the Civil War. What's her story? How can I find out more? And then I go to Chaplain Van Horn's records. She died July 16th, 1864 in a hospital in Marietta, Georgia, was buried a half mile south of the city of Marietta in the 17th Army Corps Cemetery. Next to her documentation, it said colored, standing for an African-American nurse. We only know of three of these nurses of African descent that actually got into the Army as nurses.
Three in the entire Civil War?
In the entire Union Army.
In the Union Army. Wait, that implies that maybe there were more on the Confederate side? Because that would seem crazy.
The documentation I don't have on it, so I can't make an assumption about that. But I do know from the Atlanta campaign that Emma was the only one of African descent in Sherman's army that I've documented. And then I have to know more. You've got to know more about this woman who died in Marietta July 16, 1864. So I start to pull the mother's pensions of Union soldiers from the Atlanta campaign, find 23,000 Civil War letters from these mother's pensions, and five that mention Emma Stevenson.
What is a mother's pension?
Well, in 1862, the mothers were allowed to file for their son's pension from the Civil War if they could prove their son sent him money home. And the only way to do that was to send the actual letters that they received from their sons to the pension office in Washington City to try to receive it. These have been hidden away. Researchers are now getting the scope of what's important in these, and to find five that talk about Emma was a great moment for a researcher.
How many of these, there were more than 200 of these graves that you found in Marietta Cemetery. How many have you now put names to?
I've at seven right now, and I just got back from Washington, D.C. on an 11-day trip to find more information. I want to, and I truly believe, that I can identify 100 of these unknown African Americans.
Well, that's a lot, actually, because, I mean, the records from the Civil War are kind of hit and miss, are they not?
For the Union side, they're incredible, and many of them are undisturbed, still to be found.
Although, again, it's difficult. There was spotty record keeping. I mean, you can get lucky with somebody who kept very good records, and that's just pure luck for a historian, is it not?
Yeah, it's a joy, and it's and I'm finding more and more. And the more I go to the National Archives in D.C., the more records they allow me to pull that are very fragile.
Let's hear one more clip from the documentary. The documentary is called Kennesaw, One Lost Mountain, and it's mentioning these two freed slaves that you researched.
Emma and Austin are buried with the honored dead from Kennesaw Mountain. Austin in an unmarked grave. Though their lives were tragically cut short, Emma and Austin died free. And they died knowing that the end of slavery was no longer just a dream.
Were you able, Brad, to turn up any other information about their lives before they entered the Union Army?
I know a little bit more about Emma. I went to Camp Nelson in Kentucky. It was a large USCT training camp. And I went and found, was allowed to go back into their archives. And then I found a reference by the surgeon of the 8th Iowa Infantry that talk about Emma, her incredible work and dedication to sick men, and he recommended her to become a nurse in the Union Army.
How many of the, again, it's USCT stands for United States Colored Troops, how many died at Kennesaw? All of those, were all of those graves that you found in Marietta from the Kennesaw Battle?
From the Atlantic Campaign. I have two that were killed on the battlefield of Kennesaw Mountain, and 13 more of these stretcher bearers that were wounded and later died in Rome, Georgia.
So where do the other 200-some come from?
All over. The Rome, Georgia, Atlanta. One was killed September 1st, 1864 in Jonesboro, July 22nd, 1864 in the battles for Atlanta near where the cyclorama is today.
And they transported them all back to Marietta to be buried?
All of them in 2 years, 1866 to 1868. Chaplain Van Horn took all the remains of all these men and Emma, and took them to the National Cemetery in Marietta, Georgia.
So you have identified seven. You're hoping to identify 100. You're at the very beginning of this.
It's 20 years of research right now, putting it together, and things are really starting to move a little bit faster, and I'm putting information together now, hoping for more.
Still more to come. Brad Quidlin, historian and researcher. You can learn more about the Battle of Kennesaw by checking out that documentary. It's called Kennesaw, One Last Mountain. Brad, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and let me tell the story of Emma and Austin.
This is On Second Thought. Ask you a personal question. How do you like your barbecue? I would be willing to bet that every single person has a slightly different answer to that question. We all have really different tastes. So you'd think there would be all different kinds of people to write about all the different kinds of tastes. But Kathleen Purvis is food editor for the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina, and she says the food writing industry is too much the same.
For the last decade and longer, the food culture of the South has drawn attention from an often New York-based cadre of writing chefs and chefing writers like a mermaid perched on a red clay reef. And that writing is often focused on a male perspective that's starting to reek of hickory smoke and pig fat. Bourbon, barbecue, and pork belly, God help us, are interesting. I have loved those assignments. But in our rush to embrace those subjects, in our insistence upon putting them front and center in every discussion of Southern culture, are there other subjects that aren't getting covered at all? Try proposing an article on chiffon cake. or the contributions of Henrietta Dahl, who wrote the landmark 1928 book Southern Cooking, or household arts like pickling and canning, or the cooking of Mexican grandmothers. I'm glad the South has become so interesting to so many people. I'm delighted, mostly, when New York's hip-hop chef Eddie Wang finds his way to Oxford, Mississippi. I gladly joined the standing ovation for Monique Trong's love letter to Bridges Barbecue Lodge in Shelby, North Carolina. Those voices are rich and rewarding. They liven up the joint. It's just that sometimes I wonder, are female Southern food writers the only cultural group left whom it's okay to treat as tokens? How can you tell the complete story of the South without all of us at the table? When the assignments are pitched, don't relegate the female writers, particularly not the Southern ones, to just preparing the side dishes while the men fire up the pit. Don't just turn to us for the women's perspective, or when you want to read the history of cake. When you dig into the Southern food feast, there are plenty of ways to divide the pie. Just don't forget to give the sisters their half. After all, they probably baked the damn thing.
Kathleen Purvis is food editor for the Charlotte Observer. Now, Kathleen was talking about gender diversity, and we wondered if all that she said holds true when it comes to race. So we've asked some Georgia food writers to weigh in. Nicole Taylor is author of the Up South Cookbook, and she also hosts the Hot Grease podcast. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Natalie King is owner of Chinese Southern Belle, and she's a food writer for Atlanta InTown Paper. Hi, Natalie.
Ni hao, y'all.
And Dennis Byron is freelance beer and food writer in Atlanta, and he hosts a web series and blog called Cruisin' for a Bruisin', that is B-R-E-W-Z-I-N. Hi, Dennis.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Natalie, I mean, yours is a very interesting combination of the Chinese Southern Belle, and it seems to me that's a pretty good argument for needing people in the food writing industry, at least, that can understand both of those cultures. How do you think food writing has been here? Do you think it's diverse enough?
Well, I mean, I think the writing, just like the food, reflects us and our experiences. So I use food as a gateway. You know, it connects people. It exposes us to place in history and culture. So it's really when I share about my own experiences and ask others to share and connect with food, it's really a reflection of us. And so since I grew up in Atlanta, and it was a very different place back then with no Asian markets, and I was the only Asian face in school, it has certainly become more diverse, and I'm very excited about that. I mean, now we have the Buford Highway International Corridor, and we have all this interest in different kinds of ethnic food. So I'm certainly excited about the movement towards
now
that.
Now, that's interest in the food, and that's availability of the food. But, Dennis, does that mean we're getting a diverse enough cast of food writers that can appreciate all the different tastes?
There's always room for that. But I don't know if there's a word enough that says, okay, now we're good. There's 50% this and there's 50% that, and we're it's split down the middle. I think it's just what your profession is, and if you do a good job at it, then that will usually diversify itself, be it a good writer or what you specialize in. So, like, I'm in the industry of beer. You call me A.L. Sharpton, actually. Yeah, when I call my government name, I'm usually in trouble or something. But, yeah, A.L.E. Sharpton. And I see it. I'm working in the beer industry, and it's working on diversity, but it doesn't have to be pushed or forced. I just so people's taste buds are really complimented and talked about, I think that's a good start to do it.
Okay. Nicole, let me play you a comment from writer and restaurant owner Eddie Wang. He has a TV show called Wang's World. Many people watch. He travels around the world in that show. He bridges cultures through food. And this is from an interview he did for KPCC in Los Angeles.
I think the most satisfying thing is to be understood. At Bauhaus, if I make a dish and an old grandmother comes in from Flushing and says, you know what, I read about this restaurant and I love it, and it reminds me of Taiwan. That's beautiful. She understands my experience, and I understand hers. When people watch the show and they email me, I get emails, they say, I'm Puerto Rican, or I'm Ecuadorian, or I'm Jamaican, and I'm not just like you, but when I watch the show, I feel like this is my life. That makes me happy. That's why we do this.
What does it mean, Nicole? We've heard a lot of discussion about what it means to have representation, say, in Hollywood, in our movies, in our TVs, and recognizing faces that look like you and sound like you. Does that hold true for food writing as well?
Totally. I mean,
when I open up glossy magazines or log onto the internet and I'm going to my favorite food websites and I don't see stories about my South and how I grew up in Georgia, I feel like, wait, hold up. You know, we contributed a lot to American food culture. Where are our stories? So it's totally important, just like it's in Hollywood or in music or any other industry, to have our voices or more so our stories around food in media, in all types of media.
Okay. So, Natalie, I just kind of want to find out where those limits are. Somebody, the editor of Fusion magazine, tweeted out a picture of an article saying, here's the best dumpling restaurants in New York. And he circled the byline, which was Chris Crowley, who you assume is a white guy. And I think his point is that we often hear people who are not of a culture, maybe did not grow up eating dumplings. Is it possible that there are better prepared people to give reviews on dumplings? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, that's what's been frustrating, I guess, if we're going to be honest here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because I love the work that Nicole is doing. I think it comes down to how we're defining authenticity, who's defining it, and then who are we allowing to say, you know, what is authentic. And what has been a little frustrating in my journey is to see that these different kinds of ethnic foods are becoming popular, but they had to be first legitimized by the white dominant culture. Like some of the events that I've been to, you know, it was like, oh, you know, these are our family recipes, or, you know, we grew up eating different parts of the animal, or we talked about being connected to the land and eating a whole variety of food. But then it had to be legitimized first by the chefs that have the certifications or they're from New York. And so that's been the disconnect that I've seen, is that there seems to be kind of the gourmetified, or I call it foodist, kind of elitist dynamic that's evolved. And like Nicole has written a lot about, you know, a lot of times it's reflective of the women that have slaved in the kitchen, or primarily, you know, black women that have served up the food, but it's the white men that are paid as professionals. And so I see that disconnect a lot with the new ethnic popularity of food, but at the same time, it's like we're...
It's odd to hear some guy who didn't grow up with that food telling you that it's not authentic.
Exactly, and then someone to tell me that I can't be authentically Southern. Like, they hear Chinese Southern Belle, and they're like, you can't be Southern. And so that dissonance is what is, I think, is an opportunity for us to broaden the conversation around authenticity, who's defining it, and who says I can't or cannot be authentic, or what foods can or can't be authentic. And as well as Chinese American food. You know, I mean, I've had people constantly ask me, you know, where can I find authentic food? And, you know, Chinese takeout must not be authentic food. But I'm saying, well, actually, it's part of the Chinese American experience. It is part of our Asian American history that Chinese food like chow mein and chop suey are actually authentic to us, but maybe not to someone in China.
Right. All right, let's hear...
As Americans.
Let's hear actress Rosie Perez, if we're going to be fully honest, as Natalie said. She was a guest on WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful, and she is Puerto Rican of descent. So this is her talking about the assumptions people make about what she will like.
You know, it's so insulting when people go, do you still eat rice and beans? They wouldn't ask an American, you know, do you still eat meat and potatoes? You know, it's just, why would you ask me that? Is that what you see? You don't see me as a human being first. You see me as rice and beans first. And so therefore, that's why it's insulting.
I wonder, Nicole, how far that goes in terms of what you're expected to cook. And I say that as the descendant of an African-American musician who was expected to write so-called black music for all his life. Does it also affect what you are expected to make?
Definitely. And what I'm expected to write about. I think people always look at me and think, oh, you write about food, you're a cookbook author. Tell me about the fried chicken. And I'm happy to do that. but, you know, we are more than just fried chicken. And, you know, when you look at the African American or the black experience in the South, it's full of seafood. It's full of all kinds of things. And You have the Caribbean. So, yeah, people do expect me to write about Black food always. And I'm happy to do that because they're not a lot of voices or a lot of people doing that. But I do think there's room for me to talk about other things. Not only me, other people to talk about stuff beyond just Black foodways.
We would love to hear from all of you listening. Where do you go to read about food? What blogs do you follow? And does it matter to you? Do you look at the byline when you're reading a review or reading a piece about food? You can tweet us at OST Talk. My guests are Nicole Taylor of the Hot Grease podcast and Atlanta food writers Natalie King and Dennis Byron. Dennis, what difference does this make? It's not that, you know, just because you're a white guy, you can't taste good food or good cooking, right? Mm-hmm. So in the end, what difference does it make who's writing about the restaurants, who's writing about the cookbooks?
I think a lot of it has to do also with how much exposure a person gets, or a lot of magazines and websites that are, I guess, seen as legitimate, or a lot of them are white owned, so they think that those bigger magazines are the ones that make it a legitimate comment on what a good dish is, or who makes good, whatever it could be. And I think asking those people who do specialize in certain cuisine, they don't have to be necessarily directly from that country, but to know it and knowing their background, they can specialize in that way as well. It doesn't have to always be about race. But honestly, I had an interesting discussion with one of my cousins, and we're from Jamaica. And I'm asking him, what is the best Jamaican food in Atlanta? You know what I mean? And I'm taking his word a little more because he is from Jamaica. And I think that's one way to go about doing it. And also, American food sometimes is kind of tailored towards, you know, not as creative as palates sometimes. So, like, maybe spices.
That's a nice way to put it. Yeah.
Boring plan.
Yeah. And, you know, Thai food can be kind of dumbed down a little bit to kind of not be as spicy. You know what I mean? Those kind of things. But you just got to kind of dig in the crates. And that's kind of a fun thing itself, is to find those really, really authentic spots that make the food that is reflective of the country they represent.
And here's, I think, would be a really big problem, Natalie, is because to a certain extent, you know, they always call it an educated palate, right? I mean, if you haven't grown up in a culture and therefore haven't grown up eating certain kinds of peppers and certain kinds of spices, it may take you a while to realize what it tastes like when those are cooked properly, right? But you don't get a second chance at that review.
No, I mean, you know, in the end, it's almost like if the food is good, you mm-hmm. know, because we're constantly evolving. If you see food as an embodiment of the people and culture, as I do, you know, you have very rarely you're going to have a culture that is formed in a vacuum. Right? We've got so many different influences, and the influences are exciting and tasty and spicy. Why dismiss it just because we might not think it's authentic, or because, I mean, I've been to China and it's been authentically bad Chinese food there, right? I mean, because we don't want MSG, we want healthy, fresh vegetables, you know, things like that we've adapted here in America. Or there might be Cuban influences or even Jewish or Spanish influences, and it makes it very exciting, and it's reflective of who we are in our cooking and what we've become as Americans. So, I mean, I think it's just an interesting, really dynamic kind of concept if you see food as being an embodiment of our diverse, you know, history. So I think to say, oh, because you didn't grow up in China, you know, your dumpling recipe isn't as authentic, or you are Chinese and speak Mandarin, so you can't cook a really good fried chicken and collard greens, right? I think we're going to be missing out, you know, on really good food.
That's
but
a great
at the same
point.
Time, you have mm-hmm. to honor the traditions, right? Because, all right, to put bacon in sushi, for example, or to put something really kind of non-authentic, right, into a dish like sushi or in dumplings, are you being sacrilegious? Are you dishonoring that tradition? You know, and I think it's an important question to ask ourselves as people and for the food.
I agree. We have about a minute left. And Nicole, I wanted to bring you into this because it kind of depresses me to hear Rosie Perez say, would you ask an American, because she's an American? Maybe this is about just expanding. I mean, chop suey is an American dish. Mm-hmm. Maybe we just need to expand what American is when it comes to food.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I think that there are so many people, home cooks, restaurateurs, food writers who are really doing great food and honoring the heritage of different cultures. And I just feel like there just needs to be a shift to those folks. And because I think people are doing it, it's not all negative. I feel like the last few months or the last year or so, we've been talking about the lack of, and there is a true lack of, but for sure, there are people who are celebrating our food in ways that totally uplift it. And I do feel like the tide is changing, and that we can move this conversation forward and move this whole thing around diversity and food forward if we just look at the folks who are not being talked about. Go to blogs and stuff. Yeah.
A little optimism to end the conversation. Nicole Taylor, author of the Up South Cookbook, host of the Hot Grease Podcast, food writer Natalie King, also owner of the company Chinese Southern Belle, and Atlanta beer and food writer Dennis Byron, hosts a video web series and blog called Cruisin' for a Bruisin'. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is On Second Thought. You know, college is already hard enough. Imagine having to attend classes and navigate campus life with a disability. There's a push now to make that experience easier for students with hearing loss at Emory University. Our own Linda Chen reports.
Morgan Leahy was a junior at Emory University when she noticed something was wrong with her hearing. It was gradual at first, and then one day,
I was taking this music class and I just started to realize I can't hear the music samples, because they say, oh, you can't you hear the trumpet? And I would say, oh, there was a trumpet in that piece? I couldn't even hear it.
Morgan went completely deaf by her senior year. Doctors didn't know what to make of her condition, but after several tests, she was diagnosed with a severe case of vestibular disorder. The vestibular system is a set of sensory organs located within the inner ear. It controls a person's balance and sense of space. So problems with the vestibular can lead to dizziness, blurred vision, and even hearing loss.
It's kind of like if you get off a roller coaster and, you know, you have trouble seeing, you're dizzy, and worst cases, you may throw up. It's similar to that because your vestibular is having trouble calibrating, but mine is just always having trouble calibrating. It's not even there anymore. It is so non-functional.
It became essential for Morgan to learn sign language. But right now, students at Emory have only two options: either pay for classes off campus or take courses for no credit through the university's independent study program. Morgan chose the latter. Students in her program are expected to learn on their own through instructional videos. Then they meet with a tutor once a week to go over the material. But American Sign Language is complex. Morgan says there's a lot about sign language that's easy to miss.
A lot of people think that American Sign Language is just English with hands, where it actually has an incredibly different syntax and grammar structure. So that was, you know, very frustrating, because I'm trying to learn this language through video, but like I wasn't learning any grammar or anything.
Others at Emory are on her side. Students with the university's Undergraduate Disability Studies Initiative started an online petition. They want the university to offer American Sign Language classes on campus taught by an accredited instructor.
It just seems a little short-sighted that Emory doesn't offer this.
Samantha Van Horn is a doctoral student and leads the initiative. She says it's not fair for Emory to ask students to pay extra for classes when they already pay a hefty tuition.
Emory is very expensive. It's a privilege to be going to Emory in the first place. And to ask students to shell out additional money to take classes somewhere else to me seems a bit ridiculous, especially since we are such a great school.
Fewer than 200 universities and colleges offer American Sign Language as a foreign language credit. ASL is even stigmatized in the deaf community. David Reynolds is a board member of the National Association of the Deaf. He says for a long time, parents discouraged deaf children from sign language and pushed them to learn to speak instead. He spoke with me through an interpreter.
Many people in the past thought sign language was not good for the deaf person and were not allowed to use their natural native language, and it's actually proven the opposite. It's quite detrimental to force deaf people to learn orally.
But the days of hoping for a Helen Keller miracle are changing, and verbal language is no longer the ultimate end goal. Georgia State University was the first public university in the state to offer ASL as a language credit. That was 4 years ago. Susan Easterbrook says the addition was long overdue. She's a professor emeritus of deaf education at GSU. She says offering ASL classes in a university setting is beneficial because it exposes college students to a culture that's misunderstood and silenced.
The first time a student bumps into a deaf person out in the real world and has a real conversation with them, I think they all find that very exciting. And very eye-opening that, gee, I'd never really thought that people with hearing loss were out there doing things that everybody does.
She first approached the border regions back in 2007, so the students at Emory could have a long road ahead of them. More than 1,000 people have already signed the petition, including the university's president. But the future remains unclear. I reached out to Emory University. They sent a statement. It says, quote, Emory's administration has not yet had the opportunity to see the petition and evaluate the proposal. Translation, give us more time. So it might be too late for Morgan, who graduated last week, but she plans to continue her ASL education after college. And the once music major now has a new career plan.
I'm actually, in many ways, very grateful that I have become deaf because it has educated me. I would like to work in deaf education and special education if I could, but I'm still going through a transitioning period in my life as I'm settling into my new deafness.
For GPP News, I'm Linda Chen in Atlanta.
The Rust Belt spans the country from New York to Illinois. That nickname came from all the closed factories and plants during the decline of manufacturing in the 1970s and 80s. When the jobs disappeared, almost 6 million Rust Belt baby boomers left the Midwest, and many of them fled to southern cities like Atlanta. That migration is the subject of a new book by my next guest. Paul Hertnecki is the author of Rust Belt Boy, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
Now, your book began as a blog. What is the relationship of the blog to the book?
Well, when I was drafting the book, I started peeling away what I thought was the truth about the hometown that I grew up in, Ambridge, Pennsylvania, which was named after the American Bridge Company, about 15 miles from Pittsburgh. And when I would revisit my drafts, I found that they didn't seem quite true to me. And so I would draft them again. I would revise them over and over again. And then I realized I needed feedback from the people I grew up with. I didn't want to publish this thing.
To make sure your memory was accurate.
Exactly. There were some common points of memory that other people had the same memories of these places or had the same memory of the way it was. I didn't want to publish it and then take all the heat. So I thought I'd put it out there and beta test it in a way, and see whether I was going to get a lot of heat or I was going to get some positive feedback. Well, it turns out I got a lot of positive feedback, and people started to amplify what I was saying by giving me their own stories.
Okay, so you and you included some of their stories in the eventual book, right?
Most of the stories are my own, and so their stories kind of helped me understand the place better. So I would say, you know, that their understanding of the place helped me put that into perspective. So it wasn't just my perspective, but their perspective as well. Most of the characters are, all of the characters are really people I encountered.
But what kind of is at the center of this is what a huge, we talk a lot about the Great Migration, which is the movement of largely African Americans from the South to the North. But you're talking about a reverse migration in some ways when a lot of people moved South to find work. But what a culture shock that was to move from a manufacturing center in the North to a place like Atlanta down South. What was that like?
Well, as one of those people, I moved here in 1980 and stayed until 1984. It was a culture shock, but it was, I have to say, it was a rather pleasant one. Atlantans, Georgians were very welcoming to us. There were the carpetbagger kinds of slurs, but those were done tongue-in-cheek. It was probably the hardest part of the culture shock was the homogeneity of the age group.
What do you mean? Everyone was the same age.
Everyone was a baby boomer, it seemed. I used to say to large groups, I would ask them, when's the last time you talked to somebody over 60? And I'd hear silence.
Because this was in the 80s, and the baby boomers weren't over 60 yet.
Right. And Atlanta wasn't the kind of place that had a lot of public interaction at that time. There wasn't a whole lot of public transportation. We were all driving our own cars to our own offices, to our own apartment complexes. Oh, well. You know? So that kind of age diversity wasn't here. So that part of the culture shock was pretty big. I mean, I left the city. Well, I came here from Boston, but Pittsburgh at the time, when the bottom fell out of steel, had the second oldest population in the country next to Palm Beach, Florida.
So did you have assumptions in your head about what the South would be like before you moved here? You're already beginning to smile. Let's be honest, Paul. I won't tell anybody.
I don't really think I did. I think I went into it with my eyes wide open. People told me, oh, it's going to be slow down there. Slow. People talk slower, walk slower. Well, coming from Boston, that wasn't such a bad thing. I was open to that. I think that, you know, it took me a while to get used to the accent. I was in my first meeting, I heard someone in the meeting repeatedly say, suck it. And I thought, what is he saying? And then I understood he was saying, first, we got to do this, and suck it, we'll be doing that.
Oh, second. Yeah, okay, I gotcha.
So that took a long time, but this is, you know, I respected the culture here. I thought the culture here was fabulous. Everything from the food to the entertainment to the slowness.
So your title, Rust Belt Boy, mm-hmm. I ask because Rust Belt is one of those terms that many people from cities like Pittsburgh and Detroit, they don't really appreciate other people using that term, even if they use it themselves. What are your feelings about Rust Belt?
Well, it's on point. It's descriptive, just as Sun Belt is. It's a bit of a pejorative, but we're kind of proud of Rust. Rust still has an enduring quality. The U.S. Steel building, when it was built in Pittsburgh, was built of Corten steel, which is pre-oxidized steel. And in that way, it heals itself. When it's scratched or when it's marked or when it has faults, the oxidation covers it over. And I think that kind of self-healing is a lot of what the Rust Belt is about. There are a lot of ruins. There are a lot of industrial ruins. But I quote someone in the book, an Englishman, and I'll fracture the quote here, but basically a ruin really is something that is just standing there waiting for the imagination to play on it. I think that's happened in Pittsburgh. I think it will happen in Detroit. It's happening in Cleveland. And it's happening in Buffalo. It's happening in Milwaukee.
If you're just joining us, my guest is author Paul Hertnecki. His new book is titled Rust Belt Boy. So these towns that then got emptied, you're talking about Pittsburgh when you were growing mm-hmm. up and it had a very old population. What did happen as people began to move out and many of them moved south? What was left in places like Pittsburgh or Ambridge?
Half of the baby boomers were left, and they were resolute to remake it. And that's kind of who I dedicate the book to, those who stayed. And they stayed and took care of the parents. They stayed and supplied this gravity that kept us all loyal to those places. But also in Pittsburgh, because things went down so fast in Pittsburgh, as opposed to Detroit, where the auto industry lingered, Pittsburgh had to remake itself. And so it started delivering health care in a different way. It started addressing the needs of elders. So they actually have health care systems that will now be adapted to baby boomers much more smoothly than it will be in other cities, the aging baby boomers, because they know how to deliver health care to an older population.
Because they were sort of the leading edge of that crisis.
Right, exactly.
Now, why you came down to Atlanta, you were only here for 4 years. Why did you leave?
A couple reasons. One, I missed the Northeast.
What were the things specifically that you missed?
I missed being able to live in the mountains and get to the sea within an hour and a half. It's a very compact
Atlanta
place.
Is landlocked.
Yes. I missed the cities of the Northeast. I missed my family. My wife's family is from Connecticut, and she wanted to be closer to them, and I wanted to be near Pittsburgh. We spent all our vacation time visiting family, and I love my family, but that's not the same as vacation.
Right. But did you hear, as you were sort of focus grouping your book through the blog, did you hear from other people whose families had moved south and then stayed?
Oh, yes. In fact, I would say the majority of them have stayed. And they're very happy in Phoenix and Denver and Texas and Florida and Atlanta and Charlotte.
And you never thought, gee, I wonder why they would have stayed?
No, they found work, and the weather's nicer.
Than Boston? You're kidding me.
That makes a big difference. If you don't want to shovel snow anymore, you can find places where you don't have to do that.
And I will say that in Atlanta, I've never had a cab driver swear at me.
I'm sorry.
Spoken as a true Bostonian. Paul Hartnecki is author of Rust Belt Boy. He will be at Smith's Old Bar in Atlanta tonight at 7 to talk more about that book. Paul, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest in this. It's been a pleasure for me.
That is our show for today, but we want to hear about your family's migration story. Has your family always been in Georgia, or did your parents or grandparents move from somewhere else? Our family hasn't been in Georgia since the end of the Civil War, and we've been all over since then. Tell us your family story at 404-500-9457. I'm on Twitter at Celeste Headley. The show is at OST Talk, and we're on Facebook too, of course. For today, that is On Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.